swing and a miss.
Did an injection of stem cells fix a Yankee pitcher's ailing arm? Two sports docs are here to talk about the controversial procedure using cells from fat and bone marrow to heal injuries. Some say it's safe and effective, but is sports medicine throwing us a curve? Then massive megawatts of solar power are being added to our energy portfolio. We'll get an update on the world's largest solar facility under construction in California and Google's latest plan to add residential solar to the mix. Plus, in a flash of gamma rays, a star gets gobbled up by a black hole. We'll talk about that cosmic event and other news of the black hole kind after this break. Stay with us. Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Astronomers say they may be seeing the last dying gasps of a star as it is being gobbled up by a massive black hole. The evidence? Mysterious high-energy gamma ray bursts, first picked up in March. These high-energy bursts are not uncommon, but this one has lasted far longer than usual, tipping off astronomers that something big was happening about 3.8 billion light-years away. The news was reported in two papers in the journal Science. That, along with another report about a slew of supermassive black holes previously hidden, existing in the very early universe, means it's time to get an update on all things black hole. And who better to do that than Lawrence Krauss, director of the Arizona State University Origins Project, his latest book, Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science. Welcome back to Science Friday, Lawrence.
It's always good to be back, Ira.
Thanks for getting up early, and I know you're in Australia, so.
Yes, it's a good time. It's quite black here, so it's right now, so it's a good time to talk about black holes.
Good. Also joining us is Joshua Bloom, Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of California, Berkeley, and the lead author of one of those science papers. Thanks for talking with us today, Joshua.
Happy to be here.
Lawrence, let me ask you first. Let's just get grounded a bit and talk about what a black hole is.
Well, simply, a black hole is something that's so massive, the gravity is so great, that the escape velocity from its surface is larger than the speed of light. And since nothing can travel faster than light, nothing can escape, not even light. So it's something that is completely separated from the rest of the universe. And I should say that black holes are a theoretical construct. We see objects that we think are black holes, but we aren't 100% certain. They're just so massive and so dense that according to our theories, they can't be anything else. I should say that they come in all different sizes, and one could imagine black holes ranging from the size of smaller than an atom up to billions of masses, solar masses, and they have very different properties depending upon their mass, very different densities, and we think they form. We're reasonably certain they form at least in one simple way when some kinds of very massive stars collapse, so that there are 10 to 100 solar mass objects that, after they burn their nuclear fuel, there's nothing to hold them up, and they collapse down to become a black hole. In fact, it was thought that it was originally impossible for that to happen, and John Wheeler, the physicist, originally argued that that shouldn't happen, but eventually came around to realizing it must happen and coined the term black hole in the 1960s. And it's such a wonderful term that it's captured the public's imagination.
Mm-hmm. Joshua Bloom, tell us how you came to the conclusion that a giant black hole had gobbled up a star.
Well, we arrived at that through a bunch of different observations that allow us to put this picture together. It was the energy, it was the time over which this event called Swift 1644 plus 57, probably easiest just to call it the event, because it's a bit of a mouthful. The spectrum that we observed across the electromagnetic spectrum, and in fact the location of this one event near the center of a distant and quite anonymous galaxy, all of those pieces of evidence led us to believe that what we're seeing is indeed a black hole swallowing a wayward star as it happened to get too close to that black hole. And the black hole beamed a jet of light and particles at us at Earth, which is why we saw these high-energy gamma rays. It's one of the sort of counterintuitive notions about black holes that I think it's worth bringing up, that we think of them as these cosmic vacuum cleaners in many ways, sucking up everything around them. But actually, around black holes is where we get a tremendous amount of light in the universe. It is an efficient place to change mass into light in an E equals mc squared sense. And so when you have gas swirling around a black hole, that gas gets very, very hot. And before it falls in, it can be seen across the universe.
So what would you have to do then to prove that this is what you're actually seeing?
Well, scientists like to stay away from the word prove, just because there's always that little shred of doubt that is actually an important component of what we do. But what we can keep on doing is take more data, and particularly take some data at radio wavelengths. So this is some of the longest radio light and light in the electromagnetic spectrum that we can observe. And this object has been putting out copious radio photons in addition to visible light photons. And we may be able to see a jet emerge from this event over time. It will take a little while for us to be able to actually see it with even the sharpest radio eyes. But that may be one way to really solidify it for the community. There are other possibilities out there of what this could be, but it's the combination of all the observations we have now that really are, I think, starting to make this picture a bit stronger. One of the predictions of what it is that we're seeing, indeed if this is a black hole swallowing up a star, is that this event should never happen again. I think it's worth thinking about black holes and the life cycle of black holes, not just in their sizes and in their masses, but in what they do to the surroundings. Many black holes are sitting there essentially dormant. The black hole at the center of the Milky Way, for instance, is considered to be a dormant black hole that is not gobbling up lots of gas around it. It's not gobbling up nothing, but it's much less than many other black holes, about 10% of them, that have a tremendous amount of gas swirling around them, producing what are commonly called as active galactic nuclei, or quasars. And those black holes, we might think of their eating habits as ones of essentially voracious eaters with voracious appetites that last for millions or tens of millions of years. But the black hole that gave rise to this event that we're interested in was something more of a picky eater.
It's hard for us to understand this, think that you're saying it would never happen again. That's an absolute, you said that scientists never speak in.
Well, it's a prediction, and when I should qualify never, I should say never in our lifetime or in mankind's lifetime, a prediction that this event should never happen from that galaxy again, because the chances of a star getting too close to a black hole are actually pretty small. We think from theoretical understanding and actually from some other observational constraints that this should only happen about once per supermassive black hole per million years. So that is, you'd have to look at a million galaxies in 1 year just to see one of these sorts of events. Now, this event was even stranger than that one in a million, in that we had a very special vista on that event where the jet was pointing at us and not some other random direction.
Let me get a reaction. In a short time we have, Lawrence, what do you think? Do you think this is possible?
Well, what's amazing about the universe is that it's big and old, and anything that isn't ruled out by the laws of physics happens all the time. As it was just pointed out, this is a rare event, so people may say, well, how can you believe a one in a million event? But the point is, there are 400 billion galaxies in the universe, and that we can see with telescopes, and therefore rare events happen all the time. It may be rare in any one galaxy, but if we look at enough galaxies, we might see them. And we've discovered that the universe is stranger than we almost ever could have imagined, and anything that isn't ruled out happens. And as was pointed out, what may surprise some of your listeners is everyone thinks of sort of black holes as cosmic vacuum cleaners, that if everything falls into one that's near one, but it's not the case. In fact, you can orbit around a black hole and not fall in, and black holes very effectively clear out the neighborhood around them, and after that, things that are moving far away from them don't fall in, and you have to be heading straight towards them to fall in. Otherwise, you orbit around them just like you would the sun. So these kind of things are indeed rare, but it's amazing that every time we open a new window on the universe, such as the new window we're seeing here, we're surprised.
Well, in the minute or so I have left, another new window that was opened is a team of astronomers saying that they have found the oldest black holes yet from the early beginning of our universe.
Yeah, it's amazing because what was just pointed out is true, that most galaxies nowadays, when we look at them, many of them have large black holes in their center, we think, including our Milky Way. We look towards the center of the Milky Way, we see stars orbiting around something that we can't see, and they're orbiting so fast that the only thing we can understand to explain it is a million solar mass black hole in the center of our galaxy. But what the astronomers have just seen looking for X-rays is a suggestion that even the earliest galaxies that were just forming in the universe may have had million or tens of million mass solar black holes. And that opens the question, the chicken and egg question. Were the black holes necessary for the galaxies to form? Or were the galaxies necessary for the black holes to form, or were they necessary for each other to develop? And those are the kind of questions we're going to begin to answer as we look at the earlier and earlier universe.
Mm-hmm. One last question for you, Dr. Bloom. Where do you go from here?
Well, I think we need to understand whether we have actually seen an event like this from another galaxy in the past. There's great historical archives at high-energy wavelengths taken by many satellites over the last several decades. Now that we know what to look for, we need to ask that question, have we actually seen this before but never recognized it? And if we haven't, that gives us a pretty good handle on how often this sort of event happens. If we've seen it, then it allows us to start actually doing some sort of demographic studies of these. How were the other events different from this one? It allows us to get, a very nice picture of how black holes in this very interesting eating channel of swallowing up stars rather than gobbling up gas, how it is that they actually grow, how often does this event actually happen, and try to nail that down.
And Lawrence, what's a big question you'd like to know about black holes that are unanswered questions?
Well, I'd really like to know if they're really black holes. As I say, everything we can see is indirect, and right now we say if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck or quacks like a duck, it's a duck, and these things look and act like black holes, but we haven't yet seen the really smoking gun that tells us that our theoretical understanding of gravity at its extreme limit is really true, and that would one day be wonderful, and we're not there yet.
All right. I want to thank both you gentlemen for taking time to be with us, especially you, Lawrence, out in Australia for getting up or staying late or whatever you did.
Pleasure.
Lawrence Krauss is director of the Arizona State University Origins Project. His latest book is Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science. Joshua Bloom, associate professor of astronomy, University of California at Berkeley, and lead author of one of those science papers about black holes in this week's edition of Science. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much.
Happy Father's Day to you. We've run out of time for this segment. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about using stem cells. Can and are stem cells being used to treat illnesses? And one special case, famous case of New York Yankees pitcher Bartolo Colon, who went out of the country to get a treatment, but we'll learn that it's more common than you think it is. We'll have some details after this break, so stay with us. To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town, or on the other side of the country, or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code Science. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code Science. Make your next meeting a go-to meeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A year ago, Yankee pitcher Bartolo Colon was no longer pitching for a major league team. Closing in on 40 and plagued with injuries, it seems like the former Cy Young winner's career was just about over. But after signing with the Yankees this year, Colon's career seems to be in full swing again. He's won 5 games. He has an ERA of earned run average of 3.1. And although he's currently sidelined by an injured hamstring, he's on pace for a better season than he's had in years. What happened? Well, we're not quite sure, because his amazing comeback is being attributed at least in part to a controversial medical treatment involving injecting cells taken from his own body back into spots where he has injuries. The cells then repair the damage. Colon reportedly had the procedure in April of last year in the Dominican Republic. And while the procedure is not itself illegal, Major League Baseball is looking into it to make sure no banned substances like human growth hormone were used. Joining me now to talk more about it are my guests. Rick Lehman is an orthopedic surgeon and medical director at the U.S. Center for Sports Medicine. He's the former team physician for the Florida Panthers, the Tampa Bay Lightning, and the St. Louis Blues, and he joins us from St. Louis. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Lehman.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Scott Rodio, MD, is an orthopedic surgeon and co-chief of sports medicine and shoulder service at the Hospital for Special Surgery here in New York. He's also associate team physician for the New York Football Giants. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Rodio.
Thanks for having me.
Rick, what do you know about the Colon treatment? Because it really has not been published very much, has it?
Well, I think it hasn't been published in terms of exactly what happened. I think people can put the pieces together and went down to the Dominican and had combination therapy. I think he had stem cell and probably PRP, and then was re-injected with PRP about 6 weeks later and had it both in his elbow and both in his shoulder. And what no one really seems to know, and maybe Dr. Rodio knows, is whether he also had an arthroscopic evaluation at the same time.
Let's get into some details about what you mentioned. The stem cells, where were they taken from? Where were they put?
In his situation, they were taken from fat. We normally take them from bone marrow, and they were put in his elbow, in his shoulder, in the areas of his rotator cuff, and in the area of his ulnar collateral ligament, or the inside ligament in his elbow.
And what happens? The stem cells then repair the damage?
Well, stem cells are precursor cells, or very immature cells, and they're going to recruit blood supply, and they're going to supposedly enhance the healing of the ligament, the rotator cuff, which is a tendon, and the ligament, and improve the healing mechanics, allowing the damaged tissue to heal certainly much better than it would heal in a conventional manner.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned PRP. What is that?
Platelet-rich plasma, and that's a technique where the athlete's blood is drawn. It's spun down. It's then re-injected into the injured area, trying to, again, take the elements, the cytokines, the things that help heal tissue, et cetera. So in a hamstring tear and a rotator cuff tear, you're trying to enhance the healing process.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to talk with us about what we're about sports medicine. And specifically about using stem cells for treatment, PRP. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Dr. Rodio, I know there are some experts who take issue with calling these actually stem cells. What is your view on this?
Right. There's a lot of variability when you talk about these kind of cells and cell-based therapies. Cells can be a true stem cell, kind of by definition. To be a stem cell means a cell can self-renew, it can kind of renew itself, and it can differentiate into a number of specialized cells in the body. And there's wide variability in the ability of different types of cells to do that. So, you know, truly cells that are embryonic are so-called pluripotent cells and can form most, but not all tissues on the body. Most of these cells are taken from adults, such as in this case, and I don't know any details about Colon, so I can only comment generally. But cells taken from fat or bone marrow, as Dr. Lehman mentioned, those are typically multipotent cells. That means they can generate a limited number of cells, you know, cell types in the body. So tremendous variability. When you talk about stem cells, we need to really define what are we talking about. And that's part of the
the difficulties in studying this area is there's such tremendous variability in the types of cells that are used.
Dr. Lehman, how common are these treatments, especially ones about the so-called stem cells?
Well, I think they're common, are becoming more common, and I think they have been used for a period of time. I think initially people use this PRP, and again, there's the research is all over the place in terms of does it help, does it not help, does it enhance healing? And as things sort of progressed, people then started using either bone marrow with the PRP or fat cells with the PRP, again, trying to recruit other stem cell lines or other cell lines, as Dr. Rodio said, and I think it's becoming more and more common, and I think the science behind it is probably becoming a little bit more and more murky. But
well, isn't that a dangerous thing to have murky science doing this on people?
Dr. Rodio wrote sort of the key paper on this, and I think the paper is a great paper, trying to really understand what's happening. I don't think it's unsafe because you're taking Bartolo Colon cells and injecting them back into Bartolo Colon. So I think from a safety standpoint, I don't think it's unsafe. Is it efficacious? Is it going to enhance healing? I think that's the real question, and that's something that we will come to understand.
Dr. Rodio?
No, it's well stated. I agree 100%. I think that, I think I'll start by saying I think it's a compelling, the underlying biologic rationale makes sense. It has tremendous potential. It is safe. It's, cells or blood, in the case of PRP, from the individual. There's just a lot we need to know more about the exact cell types we're putting in. My cells are different than your cells. So how do an individual cells really function? What do we really put in to the body in different sites? And then how do we stimulate those cells? PRP, exactly. You might ultimately combine PRP, which brings in the different growth factors and things, with cells. So cells by themselves may not be enough. The PRP by itself may not be enough. The two together may have some real potential. We just need better data as to how to best use this for different anatomic sites. Different tissues are different as well.
Why is there no good data? Why are there no good studies about this?
We have a good amount of animal data. Human data, though, is much more limited. Well, it's hard to do high-level studies. It's frankly a newer technique as far as some of the contemporary techniques have only been around for a couple of years. Studies are costly, and I think we've identified now what the important variables are. And now we need to do those studies. We simply need to collect careful data on our patients. As Dr. Lehman mentioned, they're being used a fair amount, and that's probably fine. They're safe. But I would just advocate that we carefully study those patients in whom we use this and really look at what we're putting into the patients so that we can truly understand what is effective, what is not, what parts are effective, to really start to have a more refined understanding of this whole area.
Dr. Lehman, is it ethical to do these things on people if you can't say to them, this is going to work?
Well, I think, first of all, it's ethical if you explain exactly what the technology is, what you're doing, what the expectations are, and you're very, very honest with the information that's out there. So, yes, I think it's ethical. And in Bartolo Colon's case, and in many athletes' cases, there's really not a whole lot out there for a 37-year-old pitcher who's pretty much done. So if this is your only shot and the one thing that may make a difference, rotator cuff surgery on a 37-year-old pitcher or any pitcher is probably not going to work all that well. So I think, yes, it's ethical. And I think there's sort of two things. One is Dr. Rodio's right. The basic science research has to be done. And then I think we need to do clinical research, and that is double-blind studies looking at these patients, these human people, and saying, are they really any better than our conventional rotator cuff repairs? My personal opinion is that they are. And I think our results are better since we've been doing it. But, again, that's what I say isn't really science until we studied it in a true study.
Dr. Rodio, do you agree that the stem cells, the PRP stuff, does give positive results?
Yeah, I've seen some positive results. I think that there's a fair amount of variability out there, but I think there can very much be positive results, and I would be optimistic about it. I just think, again, we just need more information as to really the best cell type, and that may vary for different anatomic areas. If you're injecting a shoulder versus an elbow, or different tissue types within a given joint. So I guess a lot of variables to understand still.
There were some. The baseball is investigating and interested in it, not because it might be an illegal procedure, but possibly there was the use of human growth hormone, which is a banned substance in baseball. Why would that be mixed into this cocktail of what's happening? What would the advantage of that if it was at all used?
Well, I think growth hormone in general, people, athletes use, people have used for years, and clearly that people feel that that's going to enhance your rehab and enhance your ability to strengthen. I think the other issue, though, is you've got a pitcher and a part owner of an NHL team, and your athlete goes to the Dominican Republic, you have a contract, et cetera, and then your athlete is kind of out of your care and treatment. So I think there's some other issues. But in terms of the HGH, it's a banned substance. It's illegal. It certainly, in most athletes' mind, would enhance the healing and improve your strengthening. And if that were, in fact, used, and Dr. Rodio could talk more about this, I got to think that that's going to be a big problem.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the rationale to use it would be, you know, HGH has a real positive effect on basic cell physiology, cell proliferation, matrix synthesis. It could actually help stimulate the cells you inject. Certainly HGH, we know by itself, can have a positive effect. So at the same time, it's a banned substance. So, again, I don't know the details of Bartolo Colon's case, but it's a banned substance. And so, quite new, you know, and it makes it hard to interpret the effect of any cell therapy if you also have another factor that may have contributed or led to the positive result.
Dr. Lima, we've talked here on the show about using pluripotent stem cells to treat diseases, and one of the concerns that came up is tumors. You get cells that could divide uncontrollably. How do you know that this wouldn't cause a tumor in these kinds of cells that are being used?
Well, again, I think if you have cancer cells are, again, cells that are dividing rapidly. Maybe they're in an area that's anomalous. Maybe it's an aberrant cell line. I think when you're taking bone marrow aspirate and you're taking PRP, so you're taking blood products and a cell line and you're injecting them, I don't really think that there's any increased chance that you're going to create a line of cancer cells. That just wouldn't be scientifically based. If you have cancer and you were to take that cell line and inject it into the shoulder, yes, you're going to have some kind of transfer of the cancer cells. But to take a bone marrow aspirate in a healthy athlete, which is a normal cell line, and then a PRP blood product, I really don't think there's any risk at all for causing cancer or creating an aberrant cell line.
Dr. Rodio?
Yeah, I'd just say that the issue comes up with very, very undifferentiated, you know, very primitive cells, that risk is there. That risk would only be, you know, that the most primitive cells are cells that come from a fertilized, you know, fertilized egg. Those are truly, those cells can make any cell type in the body. And then your next level is embryonic stem cells, where there may be some risk. We're talking about here, these are adult-derived cells. The risk is essentially minimal or no risk. These are so-called multipotent cells. These are not, they're much more limited in their ability to form different types of tissue, and as such, the tumorigenicity is minimal and really not been a big concern.
Carolyn Lovell, Wyoming. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I think you should have a veterinary person on the show today, because the stem cell and IRP and all of those therapies that you're talking about have been used for years in equines very successfully. Your big equine athletes are having that type of therapy all the time.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
I know. I was just going to say we once talked about this with a veterinarian. She was telling us about how she had used stem cells in treating horses. So,
well, for instance, I have a mare who is a dressage, competitor, and she had a subchondral bone cyst on the weight-bearing portion of her femur, and they did orthoscopic surgery. They reamed that out. They harvested stem cells from her butt, from the fat, and injected those into that bone cyst, and had beautiful healing, and she's completely sound now, where she was quite lame before. It's funny because I have a human friend that had the same type of cyst in his knee, and they used the old technique of boring into the bone to stimulate bone growth because they couldn't use the stem cells and inject those because it wasn't legal, I guess.
Yeah. All right. We've got to run. We're running out of time. Thank you for sharing that with us. We're talking about stem cell treatments on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Rich Lehman, and also talking with Dr. Rodio. Dr. Rodio, what do you think about that? But it's used in animals all the time, is it, Scott?
Yeah, actually, she makes a very good point, and I'm very familiar with that literature. There's some great literature used in it, in particular for tendon-type disorders, kind of chronic tendonitis in horses. There's some very nice work done at Cornell University up in Ithaca and other places. Yep, I totally agree, and we've learned a lot from that, frankly.
And could why not just use this in athletes if it does pan out, and if this is also is being tried, and you can, you know, convince people to do really good testing about it? Could you not use this for different parts of the body than just the shoulders or the knees and things?
You certainly could. I mean, the biologic rationale is very compelling. It has great potential. In our area, we look at it for healing meniscus and cartilage and tendon and ligament and certainly bone, as was mentioned. So, again, great potential. We just need to learn more about, you know, particular cell types for different tissues, how to stimulate them, because they're probably different requirements for different tissue types.
And who would do the research? Is drug companies usually do drug research because they can sell a drug. I mean, is that one of the problems here? There is really no big money to be made on doing something like this?
Good question. There are some, there are commercial systems that are available to help one do this, so there is some commercial part of this. I think good research should be done in, your academic medical centers where it's frankly done independent from research. But at the same time, research is expensive, so we need funding from our federal dollars from the NIH or private foundations. So you bring up a good point. We need research.
Rick Lehman, what would it cost if I came to you and I wanted to have this done? What would a typical price for this to be if I'm an athlete or just someone who has a bad problem?
Well, we charge probably about $400 for a PRP injection, and we charge about $700 to add the bone marrow aspirate for the stem cells. And there are products on the market, and they're emerging. A-cell, which is an extracellular matrix from pig bladder. So Dr. Rodeo is right. And there's going to be private industry that will benefit from this if as this technology progresses. But as a technology right now, it's expensive. I mean, all medicine's expensive, but it's not crazy expensive. It's not like a cancer drug or certain technology. So although $400 for a PRP injection is expensive, you may have one PRP injection or two PRP injections at the most, or you may put some PRP on a sponge and some bone marrow aspirate on a collagen graft and incorporate into a rotator cuff repair. It's not crazy out of the realm of reality expenses.
All right, gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you guys so much. Take care.
Rick Lehman is orthopedic surgeon and medical director at the U.S. Center for Sports Medicine. Scott Rodeo is an orthopedic surgeon and co-chief of sports medicine and shoulder service at the Hospital for Special Surgery. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about growing solar power. Very quietly, a lot of solar power is being developed, maybe coming to a block near you or to your electric plug. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. ¿Hablas español? Then check out our science news in Spanish at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, the quiet but steady growth of solar power. You may not be hearing much about it, and it's quite surprising. For example, take a guess where the site is for the largest solar power facility in the world. Just being developed this week. Would you guess Germany? China? Spain? Nope. In California. Ground is being broken today in California near Palm Springs for what is being billed as the world's largest solar power facility. That project will deliver 1,000 megawatts of power. That is enough for 300,000 homes, and putting it on par with a conventional coal-fired fossil fuel plant or a nuclear power reactor. And on the other side of the country, McGraw-Hill announced plans to build what it says is the largest privately owned solar system in the U.S. at its headquarters in New Jersey. And Google is back at it again with a new solar venture. This time they're tackling residential solar. Joining me now is my guest, Alexis Madrigal, author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. He's also senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me on.
That's a huge project out there in California.
It's massive, and I think really what it shows is that solar really is starting to scale up in ways that I think people have hoped for and anticipated for a long time, but that never actually panned out in the past, say during the 1970s,
This is the Solar Trust of America's Blythe Solar Power Project. Is it out there in the desert?
Yeah, it's out there in the Mojave. I mean, I think the Mojave is, as people like to say, the Saudi Arabia of solar, in the sense that it's got a great solar resource. They get tons of sun. And it's close to major population centers in Las Vegas and the Los Angeles metro area. And even better, it matches the peak load of the of those cities. So that is to say, when the sun is shining the most during the day and people have their air conditioners on, that's when you're producing the most solar power. And so it makes sense as a business proposition, too.
Yeah, and are there transmission lines in there? Do they have to build that as part of the structure?
Yeah, a lot of the time they have to put in improvements to the transmission line, but it's not quite the same scale of problem as you see, say, with wind power in the Midwest, where you know, you've got these big wind farms in the middle of nowhere, and you've got to get that power to Chicago, or you've got big wind farms in West Texas, and you've got to get it east.
Mm-hmm. And how many jobs? It must be creating a lot of jobs.
Yeah, you know, during the construction phase of these big solar projects, say, you know, it's like 1,200 jobs are in construction. But when they're running, it's probably more, you know, in the low triple digits.
Mm-hmm. Is there any special engineering challenges here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The engineering challenge is just to get it as cheap as possible. I mean, the technology, particularly being used at Blythe, is actually really well known. I mean, during the 1980s, this what we call parabolic trough technology. Imagine like a paper towel roll made of glass, but like cut in half.
Right.
And that can actually concentrate the sun's rays on a tube of liquid that can be heated up, which then is like run to a boiler. The boiler, you know, creates steam. The steam drives a turbine, and that turbine runs a generator. And that's how you actually get electricity. And we've actually been doing that since the 1980s. In fact, the solar electric generating stations built by Luz have been cranking out 350 megawatts of solar since then.
Wow, and so this is not a great engineering challenge. It's more of an engineering design challenge.
Yeah, it's an engineering design challenge. It's also sort of a financial engineering challenge. It's kind of difficult to finance these things, largely because. Requires pretty substantial upfront investment, and so really what people are looking for is what they call bankable technologies. Can you get people to give you a loan using this technology? And that's Solar Trust of America, that's one of the big pitches, is that they're using this well-known technology. I mean, parabolic trough, even in 1913, was being used as to pump water in Egypt. So, I mean, this is a technology that really we know how it works, and we know that even though it might not be getting that much better that quickly, it doesn't need to. It's pretty close to the level it needs to be at, given the sort of incentives in California for creating solar electricity.
Let's talk about the other side of the country, New Jersey. We don't think of that as being a solar power giant, but McGraw-Hill
sure.
is planning to build the largest private solar facility.
And I think, you know, what you're seeing there, and I think what's really significant about that, is that for a long time it's been seen that the power system in the United States was very centralized. And so it was about having these big power plants run by utilities that then would feed you electricity no matter what your business was and no matter where you were. And that's really been the way that it's been since the early 20th century. But really when you see someone like McGraw-Hill like putting in a big photovoltaic installation, really that shows that we're decentralizing our power system and that more commercial and corporate users are going to be putting in their own power facilities. And they're using the grid essentially as a backup. It's what is called net metered. So they can pull power from the grid when they need it, and they can put power in when the solar panels are producing more than they're using.
Mm-hmm. And Google is taking on a new solar project. They've announced they're going to invest $280 million to help private homeowners install solar panels?
Right. So this goes to the even more extreme end of decentralization, which is not just companies and like sort of doing it in the megawatt scale, but individuals putting things on their homes. The big problem there has been, say you want to put a 4-kilowatt system on your roof, you know, you've got to come up with some tens of thousands of dollars to pay for that up front, even if over the life of the system it makes economic sense for you. So some of these companies have sprung up, SolarCity, Sunrun, Sungevity, that try and lease you solar materials, essentially. They'll put the panel on your roof, you pay a certain amount per month, and you don't have to pay anything up front. And this has been identified as a huge challenge for solar, getting over this high upfront cost. Mm-hmm. And so what Google's doing is giving them $280 million, which they can use to put those systems in place.
Is solar getting cheap enough to compete?
Yeah, you know, it's tough. I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, if you listen to someone, just this week, actually, IEEE, the Electrical Right. Engineers Professional Association, put out a report saying that, you know, within 10 years, you know, this kind of magic number that we like to throw out there, you know, within some foreseeable but not quite distant future, solar will be cheaper than fossil fuels. And they're looking mostly at the efficiency of the materials, the actual converting photons into electricity. And so, you know, if you look at the trend line, solar has been getting cheaper for a long time. It's still not as cheap as burning, you know, coal in a dirty old power plant that was built in 1960. But it's certainly not completely out of the ballpark as it would have been, say, you know, in 1975.
Now, even General Electric said this week or last May that they thought that the solar flat panels will soon be getting cheap enough to compete.
Well, and I think that's the thing. You know, there are a couple ways that people who study technology have seen that you can really bring the price of something down, right? Some of it is scientific innovation. It's more like R&D stuff. The other part of it is deployment, just getting stuff out into the field, and particularly, say, with photovoltaics, there's really two big chunks to the cost, right? There's the panels themselves, and then there's what's called the balance of system costs. That's like all the other stuff that goes into getting a panel onto your house. And what Google is really trying to juice by partnering with SolarCity and giving them all this money is to drive scale into that business of installation, because it's the sort of thing where it's not really a technical problem, it's just sort of a business problem. Like, there aren't big companies that do it, and there aren't big companies that do, you know, tons and tons of installations, although they've been growing over recent years.
Right. There was a story in the New York Times just this week about there were satellite pictures taken of New York City and seeing the tremendous potential they could have in making electricity on the roofs of all these homes and industry. You know, aren't there million home projects going on, or a million roof projects?
There are. There have been projects run by the DOE, you know, where they set a goal of you know, getting a million roofs and getting these sorts of things. I mean, the difficulty is of the real decentralized systems. I mean, so take a 1 gigawatt plant, right? So that's it's a lot of power. So in order to get the same amount of power, you know, by putting stuff on your roof, you need to get hundreds of thousands of people to commit to doing that. And that really is kind of a business challenge, right? It's about getting the word out. It's about bringing down the upfront costs by doing these leasing programs. It's about getting, you know, lobbying governments to provide the right kinds of incentives for people to do this sort of thing. And so it's just a little bit more complicated than it would have been, say, in 1960 when we were building a lot of the infrastructure that we now use, where basically the utility went to their utility board who rubber stamped it and then they put, you know, a new polluting power plant up. So I think really what we're seeing is just sort of the difficulty of changing this massive technological infrastructure that, because we've already sunk the cost in it, producing the power from it is relatively cheap now.
Let's go to Ann in California on the phone. Hi, Ann. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask the question about this big plant in California. Are the panels, the workers making these panels from China, or are they from California?
You know, that's it's an interesting question. I mean, there have been a lot of questions raised about whether or not American jobs are being generated by using green technology. On the Blythe plant, I'm not sure, although we're talking about big mirrors, right? And big mirrors are kind of expensive to ship around, so I actually wouldn't be surprised if they are made here in the U.S. And I think that's certainly something that, you know, at the governmental level, they can attach riders to certain types of contracts to say we want these things to be done here, just like you could do with, say, making sure that the jobs are union jobs or whatever.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for calling.
I don't think that that's completely true, but, you know, I think you need to look into that, because there aren't jobs.
All right. Thanks for calling. 1-800-999-8255. There is a lot amount of federal money that went into some of these projects.
Yeah, and I mean, there were two other big plants that got DOE backing. Basically got loan guarantees to put in big Mojave solar plants. And the interesting thing there is really other energy industries have gotten similar types of backing for a long time. I mean, that was a big part of the growth of nuclear power, and I think it shows that with this current administration, they're kind of backing all kinds of stuff. They've been giving loan guarantees to both nuclear and solar plants.
We're talking about solar power this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Alex Madrigal, author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Isn't one of the reasons why California is in the forefront of alternative energies is that their legislature, their government has said we need a certain percentage of renewable energy within a certain number of years.
Right, exactly. I mean, that in the kind of short term, that's what's been driving a lot of this action in California. The California Utility Commission and a lot of the governmental forces have been kind of really drawing on the private industry, saying, look, we'll do what we can to help you out because we want to have a certain amount of our power come from low-carbon sources. That's actually created some controversy because you are putting these big plants out in the desert that take up thousands of acres. And though the Mojave Desert is vast, you are in fact, destroying the habitat of certain types of wildlife, particularly like the desert tortoise. You're taking out certain types of trees and other, you know, kind of desert-specific flora. And I think one of the big problems is we don't really have a methodology for evaluating the costs and benefits of these projects, right? So we're getting low carbon power out of it, but we're giving up habitat. Like, how do we compare those two things, which are qualitatively so different?
Mm. Well, they did investigate the tortoise issue, and they found out that they can safely for the tortoises build those power those
right and I think there are a lot of solutions and workarounds to these types of things. I just think that this is new territory for us. You know, putting in power plants that take up thousands of acres is something that we really haven't had to do before. And in particular, the environmental movement has sort of really wanted to see green technology take off. But some of the repercussions of that success, I think maybe we haven't thought all the way through.
And not as easy as we thought it would be.
Right, yeah.
Let's go to James in Phoenix. Hi, James.
Oh, hello, and thanks for taking my call.
Hi, go ahead.
I've got 5 kilowatts worth of solar panels sitting on my roof. I don't know why everybody in Phoenix at least doesn't have them. It's cut my annual electric bill in half, more than in half. And last 2 months, my cost for electricity has been zero.
Wow. And how much when did it pay for itself? Has it paid for itself yet?
It's supposed to take 4 years
to
pay for itself.
Just 4 years.
APS gave me a rebate of about half the cost, and the federal tax credit and the state tax credit resulted in me paying zero taxes. And in fact, I've got a tax credit left over that I get to use next year.
Did someone help you figure this all out, the power company or the solar power maker?
Yeah, I contacted a couple of solar power installers here in Phoenix, and they sat down, and we went over all the numbers. Oh, by the way, they're all American-made solar panels as well. So all the jobs are here in America. In fact, SunPower, I believe, is putting in a plant here in Phoenix.
Wow. So if you want to do it, you can certainly find people out there and construction people who can run the figures and show you how it might work.
They can.
And help you do it. All right. Good. So you're knocking on your neighbor's doors now to tell them to do this, or?
Well, I talk to them all the time, and apparently money's a little bit tight for a lot of people right now. But if you can come up with $16,000, you can get 5 kilowatts, and for me, it's a good deal.
Pay for itself in 4 years. Thanks for talking with us, James.
Okay, thank you.
1-800-999-8255. Alexis, in the half minute I got going here, you think this is a positive sign, or—
Oh, I think it's a definitely a positive sign. I mean, I think, as we heard from the last car, the informational friction has come down a lot. Companies on the internet now are able to let you use Google Earth to position panels on your roof and see how much power you could get out of them. And there's just a lot of ways that getting and going solar has become easier over the last, you know, couple of years.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome. Alexis Madrigal is author of Powering the Dream, the History and Promise of Green Technology. He's also a senior editor at The Atlantic.
Support for Science Friday comes from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.